Hello and welcome to this, the sixth episode of A Life in the Landscape, a sometime becoming more regular photography podcast by me, Peter Cox. And I'm here with my good friend, I said it the last time, so I better say it again this time, Mr. Roger Overall.
Sorry, I'm distracted and blinded by this huge orange thing outside.
Jeez, you want to sort of talk to your neighbours about that.
I know. Well, no, talk to my neighbour. It's yours. It's not. Hello. Thank you for having me on your podcast again. The orange thing is not Peter's beard. It is, in fact, Peter's new car. A magnificent thing. Peter, do you want to tell people about your new gear acquisition? Because I remember, just to put this into context, because Peter, landscape photographer, you go where no photographer has been before. You boldly go where no photographer has been
before. Where no sane person would go.
So you need a vehicle that can get you there. But I remember the first time you and I went out together, and I thought, I'm going out with Peter Cox. Peter's, you know, he's full-on landscape photographer. This is going to be the full-on Defender experience. In fact, it's probably going to be a modified Defender jacked off the ground with huge tires that will take us anywhere. And you turned up in a BMW, which I thought was very civilized.
Yes, I hasten to add that it was a very old BMW. Yes, I seem to go back and forth between that sort of thing, actually, because shortly after that, I had the Land Rover Defender. Well, actually, before that, there was a rather short-lived Nissan Patrol that came to a rather bad end. That had to be...
you can't let it hang. How did it come to... You make it sound as if it came to... You had to have it put down, basically.
I sort of did. It sort of put itself down, actually. I bought it secondhand, and it was my first 4x4 vehicle that I'd ever bought. And I didn't really know. I just really knew I wanted a Nissan Patrol, and I didn't look all that closely at it when I bought it. It did fine for a long time, but then I abused it through constant use. And then there was a particular incident that involved some individual that wasn't me driving it in a way that was not necessarily most conducive to its health, and for reasons of basic health and safety. I shan't go any more than that. But it developed a problem, and I got the sense that it was going to die completely, and I wasn't in the AA. I had no towing plan, and I had to take it up to Dublin. So I thought, well, I'll join the AA because I really think that I'm going to need them. So I joined the AA, and the very next day it died completely. Like the flywheel in it went, and the drivetrain basically fell to bits. And it was literally a case where you start the engine, but there was nothing connecting the engine to the wheels in any meaningful way. And so it was in Dublin, and I called the AA to say, yeah, my car is completely dead. And they said, okay. They said, oh, we see you just joined yesterday. I said, yeah, I know. I joined because things looked like they might go bad and I wanted to be covered. And okay, well, we can tow it for you. Where should it be towed to? I said, well, it should be towed to Cork. So they were not happy. And in fact, they sent out the guy to look at it. And he said, this didn't just happen. This happened like last week, didn't it? Come on, be honest. This happened and you needed to get back to Cork. So you thought you'd be cheap and join the... I said, honestly, I see how it looks that way, but that is not what happened. And I don't think he believed me, but he had no proof otherwise. So he had they did it. So thank you very much to the AA for that. And I did not deliberately try to pull one over on you. Anyway, yes. So I then went with the Defender, with the Land Rover Defender, which was a wonderful car. And in fact, it pulled your car out of a ditch at one stage.
It pulled my car out of a ditch at one stage. It got me up to Dublin when I remember being at a conference and somehow lost my keys. And I got home from Dublin to Cork, and you were going up to Dublin the next day or soon afterwards. And I was able to go up with my spare key to get my car. And what I remember from that trip is being on the motorway and you saying to me, because it's quite a noisy experience, but I do remember you saying to me, look, you know, it will go faster, but there's no point because we'll just be, our bones will be rattled out of our body. That's how bad it will be.
Yeah, and it was a fantastic vehicle because it let me get places that I couldn't go otherwise. And I suppose people might, well, you were talking about photography on a podcast. Why are we talking about cars? Well, the cars are the way that we get where we're going. And the Defender was fantastic for that because if I wanted to go somewhere and I was carrying a load of gear, particularly when I was doing time-lapse work with the big rails and all that stuff, it's not stuff you can just carry on your back. And having the ability to drive someplace that I couldn't get to otherwise was really, really useful. So I went up all these tracks and things that you couldn't possibly take a normal car on. But it was terrible on long journeys because it was rattle trap. You'd have the radio going, driving on the motorway, and then you'd get to where you were going, you'd turn off the car, you'd get out, go to bed. Next morning, you get back in the car, turn the car on, the radio would come back on at the volume it was at the whole time you were driving, and you would be deafened because you had to have it that loud to hear it, and terrible for the hearing. So I sold that one reluctantly in the end. I still love it as a vehicle.
But I also remember, I mean, just talking about, and just to give you an idea, because we did some filming together, and me and my faux 4x4, there's a mouthful, the one you indeed did have to drag out of a ditch, and you in your red Defender, you were able to go places that I could not follow. In fact, I remember watching you and Neil McShane drive up the side of a mountain on, I don't know what kind of track it was, but it was very narrow track. And I was filming, we had a sound engineer called Fiacre Muller, who we both still know, who's still in our sphere of people. And you and Neil McShane, for some reason, I don't know, part of me thinks it was a dare. You drove up the side of this mountain and it was very rocky and very narrow. And we watched you go up. And then we thought to ourselves, how's he getting down? Because it's not like you can do a 3-point turn on this track without tipping over the edge, which was substantial. I mean, this was some drop. And then we watched you reverse your way down, and we were so panicked that you were going to fall. It didn't occur to either of us to get a camera out and film this. And we had all the gear in the world, and we could have filmed this descent in reverse.
I remember
that. Because we thought, he's going to go any moment now. And I remember Neil got out of that car being on the passenger side, therefore also
which
being
was
on the
exposed
side. Yes. White as a sheet.
Yeah, I remember that. That was, yes, that was, it was, I think that was a case of because I could. I don't think there was any actual photographic reason whatsoever to go up there.
No, because we didn't say, oh, drive up there, that'll look good for, you know, we'll have a nice bit of film and we can splice that in. Because I would love to have had you, because we had radio mics.
Yes.
And it would have been hilarious to have had you guys on the radio mics just to follow the conversation as you were going up. Yes.
Of course, we can talk about radio mics and Neil McShane, but we won't.
Oh. Yes, we will. There was that time, the first time we had radio mics, and we were at Peter's house and we were testing them, and Peter and Neil were mic'd up, and Neil went to the bathroom for number ones.
Thankfully.
And he forgot to switch the microphone, the transmitter off. And he came back from having done his number ones. And he washed his hands. Guarantee you he washed his hands because we heard him do that as well. And he came back to the living room to find Peter and myself pretty much sprawled on the floor, paralyzed with laughter. Paralyzed. Anyway.
Yep.
So the Defender, now why did you sell the Defender?
Because it was just, it was being killed it's at one stage my mechanic was working on it. There was a bit of a rattle from one of the wheels, and his assistant, you know, went to take the wheel off, and the wheel came off before it should have come off. Because it, you know, I literally, I mean, it was funny to talk about it now, but at the time I was like, that could have easily happened while I was driving. I mean, there was literally, like, without taking the bolts off or anything, the wheel assembly just came loose. So anyway, I ended up that got repaired. And then shortly after that, I realized it just wasn't, because I was doing a lot of road driving, and road miles on a vehicle like that is not good. So I decided to sell it. And it actually ended up being sold to a mine operator, and who he uses Defenders just for mining, because they're a dime a dozen. Well, they're not necessarily a dime a dozen, but he basically has this big pile of Defender parts that whenever something breaks off of one of the other ones, they just takes it. So it got sold. So it's presumably, although I say it's probably been destroyed at this stage because mine work is hard work. Mm. So I got that, and then I went back to a more normal type of car, which I promptly burned the clutch out on after about 6 months of having it, trying to take it to a place that it shouldn't have gone, because I'd forgotten that, it's not really 4x4 or high ground clearance. And I got it stuck at 2 o'clock in the morning somewhere in the middle of Kerry. And I could have gone and knocked on a door, but I would have probably gotten a nice friendly shotgun to the face for knocking on a door at 2 o'clock in the morning, asking for a tow out. So I decided I'd try to extract myself, and I didn't realize how much damage I was doing to the clutch while I was doing it. So I got out, but at the expense of the clutch.
So this would have been just a regular...
Yeah, just a regular saloon. And So I've gone back to come in a big circle back to your original point. I've come back to more of the 4x4. So it's a Ford Ranger, which will allow me to, you know, it's a bit better suited to the road, but it's also a proper off-road vehicle with good ground clearance. So I can get back and be going to, especially with the big heavy drone that I have. There are times when with a drone, you can take off from wherever and fly wherever, but there are altitude limits and there are distance limits. And so, you know, being able to go to a better place to launch from, and there've many times over the process of shooting Atlantic Light where I really wanted to be able to get to those locations and I had to compromise some of my photographs because I couldn't launch from where I wanted to. And so this vehicle will allow me to do that.
I have to ask about the color because that is not an off the peg color. Sure.
It is actually.
It is.
Yeah. It's highly orange and, It's actually, if you like the ads, when you see the thing being advertised, it's their signature color for the vehicle. So it was a case of they had a couple of them on the lot and they had white, or was it white? Or I think it was white. And I hate having, I just don't see the point.
It's like it's unfinished. It's like they couldn't be bothered.
So they had the orange and I said, oh, that's kind of a nice color. And it wasn't until I got it home that I realized, A, this is actually a really big vehicle. It's bigger than I kind of thought it was. And also that color pretty stands out.
Okay. So, and that makes sense. I mean, it makes sense that you would have gear appropriate.
So it's certainly my largest and heaviest piece of photography gear. And my good friend, Steve Gosling in the UK, he has a photograph that was one of his favorites. He likes these very minimalist and sort of abstract, interpretive sort of black and white images. And one of his sayings is, if you haven't gotten wet, you haven't made a good photograph. You know, it's to say, if you go out on a day when it hasn't been raining. And he has a photograph that he took, and it's just this really rainy, and it's kind of a little bit mottled and a little bit watery. And he explains that he took that using a 15,000 pound filter, and people are like, what do you mean? This is the windshield of my car.
Oh dear. So talking of gear, you posted a photograph that just blew my mind. It blew my mind for two reasons, three reasons. First being that you actually have it and had it to photograph because it was the case containing your drone batteries.
Yes.
They have arrived.
They have finally come back. They've
something of a miracle. But I was astonished by the number of stickers on the outside. And I think that if you peeled them off, because that was just layer upon layer upon layer.
It must
have all the stickers. There are people at FedEx going, what the frickin' hell are stickers?
Exactly.
Run out of stickers.
There's a global shortage of custom stickers and all that. Yeah, so the case of the missing batteries, in both senses of the term, has been resolved. They finally came back. They've been gone for nearly exactly 6 months. And I saw them last when I closed the case, when I sent them to Chile. And I did not open that case. I saw them briefly in Chile when they arrived too late to be of use for the project, and we'd had to come up with an alternative. And then they finally came back. So I saw them, said, okay, they need to go back, address them, package them up for going back. And then I didn't open the case again until they came back. So the only time those batteries saw the light of day while I was in their presence, anyway, I'm sure customs had a look at them, was in Ireland.
So I remember my first reaction to you was, while they're away, did they get busy? Did they procreate? Because I wasn't expecting there to be that many batteries in the case.
Yeah, 24, because each the drone takes 6 per flight, so there's 4 flights worth of batteries in that case.
They're not small, 24. Either. That's the other thing. They look quite substantial.
Yeah, they're about the size of a paperback book, really, I suppose, about that sort of size, but a lot heavier. They're about 600 grams, I think, off the top of my head. Yeah, and in fact, 2 of them are dead. Because when I sent them off, if you're going to not be using these batteries for a long time, you ideally have them in a storage mode, which is a half charge, basically. And if they're sort of quite discharged or if they're fully charged, it's not good for them. Now, these ones, if they're fully charged after a few days, they actually discharge themselves to a storage charge. Mm-hmm. But obviously, if they haven't got a storage charge, if they're below that, they can't charge themselves up. And quite a few of them I had flown and had not bothered to put them in a storage charge because I knew I wasn't going to be, well, I thought I was going to be using them fairly soon afterwards. It was only going to be a few days. But they've been 6 months in a discharge state, and two of them actually are not usable anymore. They're they have six cells in them, and if the cells all have to have the same voltage. So if there's a difference in voltage between one and the rest, then it's a dangerous state, and the battery can fail, and it can fail actually quite spectacularly with explosion and fire, or drone crashing to ground and then explosion and fire. So two of them actually will need to be replaced because they're in that state.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, if I've got a couple of AA batteries and I want to get rid of them, I can go to pretty much any, I can go to the supermarket and they've got a nice little blue box that I can put them in. I would imagine if you pitched up at the local supermarket and tried to ram these into the box, you'd get some. So what do you do? How do you dispose of these things?
You can take them, I presumably, to a wee center, like a waste electronic, whatever they call it, that stands for, you know, where you go to recycle your electronics. But because of the nature of them, you actually want to denature them first because they are highly dangerous. Like if you put them in with other batteries and they are subject to a crushing or a penetrating force of any kind, they can and do explode. So you have to, you basically put them in a certain state it's been a long time since I looked into this because I haven't had to do this in quite a while, but you basically put them in a salt water and expose them to salt water for a time, and that essentially neutralizes the chemicals in the batteries and makes them safe. So that's what I'll do with these. There really isn't a warranty thing because they weren't stored correctly. And I think the warranty is probably for 6 months anyway, and that's how long they've been gone. So I think I'll just have to replace them.
But you can say, I can guarantee you I didn't use
them. They were not used.
They were not used.
So they're back anyway, which is great. And the case now certainly looks appropriate. It's a big Pelican case with a bunch it's like the guitar cases with all the stickers of where it's been on the...
It looks official. It has traveled. You can't deny that it has.
But it means now that I can fly that drone again, because I haven't been able to fly the drone since, because I got the drone back after a long delay, again, after it being stuck in customs. Like neither the drone nor the batteries actually got used in Chile. They went halfway around the world only to come straight back again unused. And we've talked about the drone before, I know, it's customs problems. So if you're a new listener, you can go back through the previous episodes and find out what happened to that. But I have flown it, and it's great. You know, I can actually get back to work with it and start working on a couple of projects.
So what is the next task for the drone then? What is it now that you've, because you haven't, in essence, you haven't been able to fly your own drone properly for the last 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, I have the small one, which I've done for the odd bit of video, and it's actually decent enough for the occasional photograph in certain circumstances. But the big drone, which carries a Sony A7 R2 at the moment, so it's 40 megapixels, you know, and it's fantastic for stills. But I had a project in mind for it, which requires it to be able to do things that it's not really able to do at the moment. And I'm like, I won't go into detail on it because it's something that I want to. It's something nobody's done before, and I'm discovering there's kind of a reason for that. I thought that I might be able to shoehorn it.
Are you basically, what you're saying is you're the James Cameron of landscape photography, who was sitting on Avatar for years and years and said, look, I got this, sitting on this project for decades, and I can't do it because the technology is not there. Your ambition outstrips currently available technology. Is this what you're saying?
I think that's probably safe to say. I don't know if I quite go to the point of saying that I was the James Cameron of photography. That would be lovely if somebody else said that, but I'm not going to say it. And certainly I wouldn't mind his money. But the essentially what I want to do is not currently feasible. I think it's very close to being feasible, and if with a bit more tweaking I might be able to make the drone do what I need it to do. But at the moment I kind of had this in mind that I thought I would be able to make it do it, but I need to realize that it's not going to be easy, it's not going to be successful, it's not really going to be practical, shall we say. I might get the odd image, but I won't get a book's worth. So I'm going to work on that in the background and see, and also maybe wait to see if the technology improves to the point where it can do what I want. But I'm now in the process of thinking about other things that I can do, other types of projects that I can do with the drone. And it's a little bit difficult because I had a couple of ideas, and I have alternately rejected them and then come back to them and said, oh, actually, yeah, I should really do that. You know, for just while we were meeting before this podcast, I was saying, yeah, I'm not going to do this particular thing. And then I looked at an image that was that sort of thing. And I go, oh, yeah, yeah, I should totally do that thing. So.
Well, and that's, well, that's the use of looking at other stuff and going back through previous photographs and looking, because you do get that inspiration. But it strikes me that this is a very Peter thing. This is a very, I'm going to try and do something that has never been done before, because I'm just trying to think back over the years that I've known you. And you embraced stop motion time-lapse photography.
Yeah.
Very early. And not just, oh, I'll just put my camera on a tripod and shoot a sequence of frames and stitch them together and it'll be a lovely video. No, you wanted the tripod to move. And then not only did you want the tripod to move, you wanted it to move in a number of axes that most people weren't actually doing. So you've always been at the forefront, even there, and you were one of the first landscape. I remember you saying this, you know, video, I need to get into that. And I remember thinking at the time, you're a landscape photographer. What you mean with my limited vision? Because you think, well, landscape photograph is a static thing. What are you going to do with video? But, you know, so this isn't the first time you've stepped. So what is it? Why do you do that? How do you go about being ahead of the competition?
I suppose I'm fundamentally a geek. I've always been a geek, and that's why I'm a photographer now instead of a painter, because that's what geeks do when they get into the creative field, is they do things that involve technology. And I remember distinctly, you know, when I started into photography, you know, it was a case of digital photography. This was back in 99 or 2000. Digital photography is now a thing that you can do that with some decent results. And so I went and spent whatever it was. I'm pretty sure it was about $850 or so on a 3-megapixel Sony point and shoot camera. Oh,
3 megapixels.
Oh yeah. Which was, you know, that was what $800 bought you at the time, which, you know, you could probably get a 6-megapixel one for $2,000 or something. But it was because it was a gadget, and it was, you know, I'd kind of had this interest in photography on the back burner for a while, but I had no interest in getting involved in film and all that. I had no attraction to that, but because there was this bit of gear that I could get that would let me do that, that was the thing. So it was a toy that then went into this interest. And I think that's pretty much been the case with all of the things that I've done, which is, something that has been a constant in my life, has always been finding something interesting, learning as much as I can about that thing, and then kind of being obsessed with it for a period. And then sometimes it sticks, like it did with photography, where I keep doing it. But then again, with photography, there's lots of little sub things that, as you were saying, that, you know, I can vary my interest. I mean, you mentioned the time-lapse thing.
I was going to say, because whereas the drone thing is clearly here to stay, the time-lapse seems to have sort of been, well, almost been pushed aside by the drone.
Oh yeah, well, and even before I got interested in drones, even before that, I mean, the time-lapse stuff I haven't done in quite a long time. And I did, as you say, you know, I had an elaborate rig, I had a big long track, like a 6 or 9 foot track that was robotically controlled, and there was a three-way, three-axis head, and then I had motors for the focus, so I could change focus as the thing was going, and I was controlling it all from a computer. And it was great, and I did it, and I satisfied my interest and my curiosity, and I did a bunch of stuff with it, and, you know, a lot of it got used. I mean, you know, like there was an RTE program that still airs occasionally, which is Secrets of the Irish Landscape, that had a lot of that work in it. But the thing is, it was a pain in the ass to do, because you had to go out, it took an hour and a half or so to set up, or, you know, the whole thing, and then you had to wait for the light, and then if it started to rain, and God knows, the whole thing was... Once the novelty of that wore off, it was becoming a chore. And so I just stopped doing it. And it wasn't, you know, I mean, I do license that footage, but it wasn't bringing in enough money to justify the amount of time that I was spending on it. So I kind of let that go. And then I've gone on the other things. Now, whereas the drone stuff is a lot easier. You know, of course, there's the regulatory side of it that you have to take care of, but that's once every couple of years. You know, you take care of the licensing and so on. But then if you want to use the drone, it's just, it's five minutes to set up and get it up in the air. So it's become easier. So therefore it sticks. So yeah, it's basically a case of, you know, being interested in something and wanting to learn about it and then seeing, you know, and I always have ideas of images that I would like to see or do that aren't possible. And like, you know, someday that, and then I see something, I'm like, oh, maybe that will allow me to do this. And try to make and it's a problem solving thing as well. It's there's enjoyment in that of saying, okay, well, how can I make this happen? And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't work.
In a way, you're a photographer of your time, because what a time to have got into photography at the launch of digital photography proper, that it became accessible to mere mortals such as you and I. And then since then, we've seen the whole time-lapse thing. We've seen drones now. I mean, but also when you got into drones, I mean, this was a serious undertaking. This wasn't, oh, I'll just order a rig. Because I now could go into Cork City and probably pick up a drone somewhere, I'm fairly sure. Whereas at the time, you couldn't. And it was a little bit more sophisticated and complicated as well, because this wasn't a just out-of-the-box experience and off we go. You actually had to put a lot of time into learning how to source the thing, make the bloody thing work, and then learn how to fly it.
Exactly. And actually, it's interesting, because you're right. It was 2014 was when I started working on this. Actually, late 2013. It was 2013, early 2013, when I decided that I was going to get into this, because I'd been doing aerial photography for a while. I, you know, have a pilot's license, which I haven't used in a long time, but I've always had an interest in that. And the aerial photography that I was doing, it was either as a guest of somebody or it was very, very expensive to do and not very flexible. And I saw the drones start to come in. I saw that they were starting to be able to carry cameras that could make high quality photographs. So you could always buy, even at that stage, you could get a basic drone that would let you shoot video. And of course, at the time, the quality was pretty laughable. It's much, much, much better now. But for stills, you've always had to go a little bit bigger. If you want to get really high quality stills, even the drones that you can buy out of the box now, they're not really at the point where you can make this kind of big prints that I like to make.
Well, and we should also point out that, you know, Peter's drone, I mean, what's the width of my desk? It's probably a meter plus. I mean, your drone would just about fit on this desk, maybe.
Yeah, with the arms stretched out, it's about a meter, 1.2 meters or something like that, I think, wide. And then it's about maybe...
You're not pulling this out of a backpack, basically.
No.
You're not doing a Casey Neistat bombing along on your motorbike.
And you can do that. I mean, for video, you can absolutely do that. But yeah. Even with the stills, you're starting to get there. But really, if you want like sort of 30 plus megapixels, you need to be going with the big thing. So at the time, I remember I wanted to get into it, but I had absolutely no desire to understand what was in the drone. Which was interesting, because it's technical. You think I would be, but I wanted a tool to do a job, and I didn't want to waste time learning about the tool or what went on under the hood. I just wanted to order a thing. So I talked to a guy, because at the time you couldn't buy a drone like that off the shelf. You had to have it built. And I talked to this guy about building one, and he agreed to build it, and it was going to be very expensive. It was like 10,000 plus for the drone, which is way in excess of what you pay just for the drone today. They're still very expensive for that type of drone, but not nearly that level. And he was building it to my spec, and it didn't work. I don't know exactly why, but basically that drone never functioned properly. Like he delivered it, and then there was a problem and a crash because of a manufacturing problem. And then it never, never worked. The gimbal never worked properly. But through all of that, I was forced to then learn what was going on so I could talk about it intelligently. And then sometime during this process, DJI came out with the first sort of out-of-the-box big drone that you could buy that was manufactured if you like, professionally. And then I just said, okay, listen, this isn't working. We've made an arrangement. And then I went and I bought the other thing. And that's how I started. So it was very much a case. It was a lot more work than I expected to get into it. But what it did then was it allowed me, because I had this background of understanding how the thing worked from the one that didn't work. So when I finally got the one that did, I had a much deeper understanding of how it worked, and I was able to use it more effectively. And then it allowed me to get Atlantic Light out before the barrage of aerial stuff that we've
Well, this is the thing, because you almost had first mover advantage in that space because you'd been through, you know, you were willing to put in the time and the effort to order at the time a bespoke drone, more or less, have it made for you. Okay, it didn't work. But even when DJI came out with their first ones that would have been fit for purpose that you were interested in, would have been beyond, I think, the appetite of a lot of other landscape photographers to get one, learn how to pilot it, learn how it worked, et cetera, et cetera. Now, yeah, now it's much easier. Mm. So I think, I mean, that being prepared to put in the work and being prepared to sort of embrace, I suppose, the unknown, because it's not like you could very easily find out, well, where do I get a drone? Obviously, you did find somebody, but it's not, you don't go into Cork and you don't say, I'll have one of your drones from what you have on your shelf, please. Not at that time. So that's an interesting thing. Just conscious of time, really.
Yeah.
I think we've been chatting for quite a while. So given that nobody's listening to the podcast anymore because they gave up 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
We can bring it to an end. If people, listeners, want to find out and see some of these aerial photographs and buy some of these aerial photographs, either as an individual print or in one or your book, Atlantic Light, where can they go?
They can go to petercox.ie, of course. And there's also, of course, the gallery in Killarney on Plunkett Street. We did move late last year. So if you haven't been there in a while, it is around the corner from where it used to be. And the Google Maps entry is correct, which is lovely because the amount of times, as a brief aside, where I go to a business and the map marker on Google Maps, and it's just sort of vaguely in the area of where they are. And the guy obviously thought, yeah, that's close enough.
That'll do, yeah.
And you end up in the back of some industrial park. Yeah, certainly that will take you directly to the door. So gallery, which is in Killarney, or petercox.ie.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to listen. And we'll see you. No, we're not going to see you again on...
We will subject your ears to us
at some point again in the future. World's worst outro.
Thank you for listening.